Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 529, titled Fascist Roots and Nazi Flowers. This has been recorded on October 9th of the year 2005. We're going to begin right where we left off at the end of Side 2. On the end of Side 2, we were taking a look at some of the Third Reich and / fascist links of elements of the John Birch Society, and in particular, we were taking a look at an Iron Guard writer, actually the former foreign minister for the Romanian Iron Guard, who had penned texts that were favored by the John Birch Society and endorsed by the ultra-right-wing JBS-linked congressman from Orange County, the late John G. Schmitz. In For the Record programs numbers 469 and 476, we took a look at John G. Schmitz's sons, John P. Schmitz and Joseph E. Schmitz, who were respectively a counsel for the Mayer, Brown and Maw international German-based law firm, one of whose partners is Richard Benveniste, and also Joseph E. Schmitz, who was the former Inspector General for the Pentagon. To make a very, very long story very, very short, both John P. Schmitz and Joseph E. Schmitz appear to have carried on not only the extremist right-wing politics of John G. Schmitz, but in particular had formed some more significant, in my opinion anyway, institutional links. And the evidence of both John P. Schmitz and Joseph E. Schmitz suggests very strongly that they were among the, that they're part of the milieu of the underground Reich. By the way, John P. Schmitz also was deputy counsel to the elder George Bush when he was vice president and president. This at the same time that the former Catherine Chumachenko, now Catherine Chumachenko Yushchenko, was the liaison between the OUNB/ABN milieu and the White House, including the elder George Bush, with whom she shared a dais in 1988. Joseph E. Schmitz has resigned his position as Inspector General of the Pentagon, and he's a very interesting fellow indeed. For the Record 476 goes into his links, and he is now, Joseph E. Schmitz, is now head of the parent company of the Blackwater Security Outfit. This is a private security outfit that employs special operations troops, and its name actually comes from one of the nicknames, or one of the part of the lexicon for the Navy SEALs, elite naval commandos. The Nation magazine carried an article by Jeremy Scahill, and by the way, there are numerous articles that talk about Joseph Schmitz, and his heading up of the Blackwater outfit. This is one of those articles. The Nation magazine's issue of October 10th of 2005 mentions Joseph Schmitz's accession to being head of the Blackwater Company, as Blackwater was among the private security outfits that was holding down the fort, so to speak, down in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. Skipping down. Just as the hurricane was hitting, Blackwater's parent company, the Prince Group, named Joseph Schmitz, who had just resigned as the Pentagon's Inspector General, as the group's chief operating officer and general counsel. That again from the article Blackwater Down by Jeremy Scahill from The Nation magazine. Schmitz's accession to the head of Blackwater is available in numerous publications. Just do an internet search and you will be able to come up with that. In For the Record programs 522 and 524, we took a look at the Safari Club, a Saudi-financed outsourcing and privatization of the core of U.S. intelligence, including, to a large extent, the CIA. In the landmark text Prelude to Terror by Joseph Trento, the trend of the privatization of intelligence and national security affairs was traced all the way back to the pre-World War II and World War II periods, when various powerful corporations, including those affiliated with the Bush family, the Harrimans, the Dulles brothers, and others, basically co-opted American foreign policy into a large extent national security policy, and that trend has accelerated and in many ways is being formalized, yea, verily, even as I speak, with the formal privatization of national security matters. Now, again, in 522 and 524, For the Record programs, that is, we took a look at the Safari Club and the privatization of U.S. intelligence, the tremendous source of wealth coming from Saudi Arabia's oil reserves as the driving economic force for the Safari Club, And I would note that Saudi Arabia has its own, not only reactionary, but explicitly Nazi links going all the way back to its inception, when the aforementioned Alan Dulles, along with British double agents and Third Reich intelligence operative Jack Philby, helped to found, quote, modern, unquote, Saudi Arabia, along with Prince Ibn Saud. I would note that even in the 1990s, Saudi Arabia hired a neo-Nazi, William Grimstead, as one of their Washington lobbyists. So the Nazi roots are very much present with Saudi Arabia as well. What we're going to take a look at is yet another source of tremendous fascist wealth, so to speak, that has flowed into the privatization of national security. And this concerns the John Birch Society and other far right-wing groups' use of the Operation Golden Lily loot that was stashed in the Philippines. In numerous For the Record programs, including 427, 428, 446, 451, and 501, we took a look at Operation Golden Lily, in which the Japanese looted all of the liquid wealth of Asia and basically used that to win World War II economically, even though they lost on the battlefield, in much the same way that the Third Reich looted all of the liquid wealth of Europe and won World War II economically, even though they lost on the battlefield. The book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, is the key text vis-a-vis the Third Reich's winning of the economic World War II. The key text with regard to Japan's winning the economic war of World War II is the book Gold Warriors by Sterling and Peggy Seagraves. That book has been accessed in numerous broadcasts, including the aforementioned programs that deal with Operation Golden Lily. One of the things that they talk about, the Seagraves, that is, in Gold Warriors, is the fact that over $100 billion in early 1940s dollars, an inconceivable sum today, was stashed by the Japanese underground in the Philippines, and that wealth has been recovered not only by the Japanese but other reactionary elements over the years. And one of the elements that has apparently recovered a lot of the Operation Golden Lily loot was the John Birch Society and affiliated elements. And the elder John Schmitz and his brother, his sons, I should say, the brothers Schmitz, who have basically taken the political philosophy of John G. Schmitz and mainstreamed it, so to speak. They appear to be carrying on the John Birch Society / Underground Reich political philosophy of their father, and they are part and parcel to the milieu that we're about to discuss. One of the major focal points of the John Birch Society and other far right-wing organizations' acquisition of the Operation Golden Lily loot in the Philippines was to use it to finance their own privatized national security establishment. I mention this because Joseph Schmitz, the aforementioned Joseph Schmitz, formerly Inspector General of the Pentagon, dealt with at great length and For the Record 476, is now the head of the Blackwater Group. We're going to turn to some portions of the text Gold Warriors by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. This was accessed in the description for the Record program number 451, Petals from the Golden Lily, talking about the John Birch Society's accessing of Golden Lily loot from the Philippines in the 1970s. By the way, there's also a reference here to the Hunt brothers trying to corner the world silver market in the early 1970s. One of the people who worked with them apparently was Mr. Bin Musalmin, who was handling a special account on behalf of Al-Qaeda for the bank Al-Taqwa, about which we've spoken so often. And in For the Record program 513, we access an article from the Financial Times which deals with the fact that Bin Musalmin, who was again handling a special Al-Qaeda account for the bank Al-Taqwa, had been indicted in the United States for attempting to corner the silver market. And in that regard, he was one of the principal Saudis working with the Hunt brothers. So in the background, as we think about what we're about to discuss, bear in mind that the Safari Club in Saudi Arabia were part of this same operation. What you're talking about is tremendous wealth, tremendous private wealth being used as the engine for a privatization of national security matters. Turning once again to some text from Gold Warriors by the Seagraves, When the Hunt brothers were trying to corner the world's silver production in the early 1970s, Curtis told us, by the way, that's Robert Curtis, a mining engineer, quote, they sent Colonel Herbert F. Buchholz to me. Later came Jerry Adams, Robert Welch, founder of the John Birch Society, Congressman Larry McDonald, and Jay and Dan Agnew and Floyd Paxton. The Birch Society was started in 1958 by a group of wealthy businessmen and far-right politicians convinced that every closet in America contained communists, Jews, and wetbacks, Afro-Americans, liberals, and homosexuals. The Birchers were also dedicated gold and silver bugs. They had a long-standing grudge against U.S. presidents, starting with FDR, who had intervened to make private ownership of gold in America a crime, with penalties of heavy fines, confiscation, and imprisonment. They also believed that Nixon had sold the United States down the river twice, first by taking America off the gold standard, second by his recognition of Red China. On the other hand, Nixon's actions made it possible for the first time since 1933 for Americans to purchase and own gold legally. So Nixon opened up avenues for the Birch leadership to acquire gold overseas and sneak it into America through the back door of Canada, where it added to the Society's fund for anti-communist activities. Like other ultra-conservative groups in America and individuals like General Lansdale, one of their own, who had been forced out of the CIA and Pentagon by liberals, the Birchers had a long-term strategy to create their own right-wing vigilante force. Not something crude like Hitler's brown shirts or Gestapo, more like a private FBI assisted by elite private military forces. Note that. This would cost money, hence the need for large amounts of privately held gold. Although he was a conservative and a patriot, Curtis was not a Bircher, but he shared their fascination with precious metals. Once he joined the Marcos gold hunt, Curtis told the Birch Society board confidentially about the hidden Japanese loot. He described his role in the Lieber Group and his participation with Marcos in sanctifying the gold and in finding discreet channels to market it. Curtis did not realize that the inner circle of the Birch leadership already knew about the Santa Romana recoveries and the role of Robert B. Anderson and John J. McCloy in setting up the Black Eagle Trust. They also knew about the roles of General MacArthur, They also knew about the roles of Generals MacArthur, Whitney, and Willoughby in the M Fund and all the financial manipulations in post-war Tokyo. They knew this because one of the founding members of the Birch Society was Colonel Lawrence Bunker, a humorless fellow who had succeeded General Bonner Fellers from MacArthur's personal staff in Tokyo. Bunker became MacArthur's chief aide and spokesman in Tokyo from 1946 to 1951, the years of witch hunting in Japan that made the McCarthy witch hunts in America look bland. The Birch Society money men who arranged the loan for Curtis were Washington State Senator Floyd Paxton and his son Jerry, who ran Quicklock Corporation, makers of the ubiquitous plastic clips used to close plastic bags in supermarkets. Another participant, Curtis said, was Jerry Adams of Atlanta, head of the Great American Silver Corporation, a precious metals company associated with the Hunt brothers. Curtis said he was informed by Congressman McDonald and Robert Welch that the loan for Curtis to work with Marcos had been, quote, cleared, unquote, by them personally. They told Curtis he was to deal directly with multimillionaire Samuel J. Agnew, who sat on the National Council of the John Birch Society. Skipping down. Once it was proved in U.S. courts that massive gold shipments did come out of the Philippines during the 20 years Marcos was president, gold that did not originate in the central bank or in mines like Benguet, the remaining mystery is, where did it go, unquote. Again quoting and proceeding and skipping down. To be sure, the gold was shipped covertly, usually after re-smelting in Manila by Johnson Mathey Chemicals using equipment Marcos stole from Robert Curtis. Before it left Manila, some was repapered by Johnson Mathey Bank, then made its way to buyers throughout the gold pools in New York, Zurich, and London. Other black bullion was sold privately to Saudi princes and Middle Eastern syndicates, or to discreet groups of Europeans through Luxembourg and Liechtenstein. Documents including waybills show that some shipments went to America aboard commercial ships and planes, while others went out on CIA aircraft to Hong Kong or to an American military base in Australia. So far as anyone can tell, the gold that went to America did not end up in Fort Knox. If it did, the U.S. government is not admitting it. So where did it go? Who was shielding and helping Marcos other than the CIA and Pentagon? Who else benefited from all this recovered plunder? Was the leverage of the federal government used to get some of this gold bullion into private hands? By the way, this, of course, is a rhetorical question. That is obviously the case. And as we reflect on Blackwater and the Birch heritage of Joseph Schmitz, who heads it up, the drive here to finance with tremendous wealth, both Saudi wealth and this looted Japanese golden wealth from World War II, to finance a national security establishment, again described here more like a private eye assisted by elite private military forces. Well, that question, I think, is answered rather effectively here. Continuing. The answer is that Marcos had connections beyond the CIA to a shadowy network called the Enterprise, a cluster of private intelligence organizations and private military firms. These were staffed by former CIA and Pentagon officers who saw themselves as paladins of the Cold War. Many PIOs and PMFs got their start in the 1970s during shakeups at the CIA. They mushroomed in the 1980s after Jimmy Carter stirred up the anthill and strongly motivated men had to continue their careers elsewhere. Skipping down, and by the way, the Safari Club that we dealt with in For the Records 522 and 524 was part of this privatization. Skipping down and continuing. Congressional hearings into Operation Phoenix, the Lockheed bribery scandal, and later Iran-Contra resulted in additional house cleaning at CIA and the Pentagon. Added to these purges were disputes between CIA officials like Ray Klein and President Nixon over rapprochement with China, and between Jimmy Carter and top military officers like Major General John Singlaub, parenthetically head of the American branch of the World Anti-Communist League, which included the ABN that we looked at in Side 1, and Air Force General George Keegan. When Carter got rid of so many professional soldiers and spooks, he does not appear to have given much thought to what they might do to keep busy in private life. No Roman emperor would have been so careless in disbanding a legion. Many of these clever and aggressive men regrouped privately with funding from hard-right organizations like the Birch Society, Moonies, World Anti-Communist League, and wealthy conservative tycoons. Like Santee's umbrella organization, the Enterprise grew into a powerful and influential network during the late 1980s. Although they were now private citizens, these men continued to have close ties to serving military officers, to top men in the CIA and the armed services. This overlap made it nearly impossible to distinguish between official U.S. government operations and those that had private objectives. This was especially true because so many of these individuals had long experience in covert operations, deception, and the clandestine use of government resources and secret funds. They were accustomed to working with CIA proprietaries that had every appearance of being legitimate companies in private industry, but were actually Trojan horses for the intelligence community and, by extension, for the armed forces. In fact, some of the PMFs were little more than fronts set up so that generals, admirals, and former spooks could continue to draw salaries and pensions as if they had never left government service. Many CIA agents spent years or even decades under various covers, so it was hard to establish beyond any doubt whether they ever left the agency or merely went underground. And by the way, William Casey was a major part of this. So again, note the flowing of tremendous amounts of World War II Japanese war loot into this drive by the American far right and explicitly fascist elements, with roots, many of them going back to the Third Reich, to set up a private national security establishment. And note also the fact that Joseph E. Schmitz, with his Birch slash underground Reich heritage, is now the head of the parent company of the Blackwater Group. One of the organizations that we looked at in For the Record 476, one of the organizations that Joseph Schmitz is part of is a group called American English. originally founded to promote English language skill among immigrant groups in the United States and boasting some pretty solid people behind it. That in and of itself, a noble undertaking, the group is metamorphosed into sort of an anti-immigrant, far-right, and in some cases fascist front organization. Joseph Schmitz is part of that. One of the other members of American English is none other than Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger of California. Schwarzenegger, by the way, as we looked at in For the Record 520, has also endorsed the Minutemen. The Minutemen were this group of vigilantes who were patrolling the Mexican-U.S. border in order to keep, quote, illegal immigrants out. It's not to say there aren't illegal immigrants coming in. However, I think the privatization, once again, of a security function is something that is to be looked at with great caution. And as we looked at in 520, despite disclaimers by its founders, there was considerable participation by various far-right and explicitly fascist elements in the Minutemen. And Governor Schwarzenegger endorsed their activities and said California needs something like that. In numerous broadcasts, I've talked about Governor Schwarzenegger and the fact that his smiley public persona actually masks a truly sinister individual. By the way, just how sinister he is has not gotten a lot of publicity outside of California. While professing giving lip service to a few touchy-feely issues like, you know, superficial environmentalism and other things, basically Schwarzenegger is exactly the sort of arch-reactionary/fascist that I figured he would be. And to give you an idea of just what a monster he's turned out to be, and this has had very little discussion outside of California, among the things this guy has proposed while professing to crusade against special interests and taking all the corporate money he possibly could get, he can pocket, he's proposed eliminating, as part of the budget slashing, you know, fund-saving measures, he's proposed eliminating survivors' benefits for the widows and children of firefighters who were killed on the job. Maybe somebody should give him one of those NYFD hats that, or T-shirts that people have been wearing after September 11th. I'm sure Schwarzenegger would go for it. He'd probably get away with it, too. But the guy's a monster, and frankly, yours truly predicted that he would be exactly that. I cited his father's Nazi activities and some of the curious aspects of Schwarzenegger, from his own superficial Nazi professions to his support for Nazi war criminal Kurt Waldheim, something he has never recanted. And I predicted that basically the governor would turn out to be, his accession would turn out to be the Triumph of the Shill, and a number of those programs are named Triumph of the Shill. In For the Record 421, we dealt with his father's Nazi heritage. His father was an early Austrian member of the Nazi Party. He then became a German Feldgendarm, basically a member of the German military police in World War II. He was classified by the Austrian government as a Class 3 war criminal, and he was, as a member of the Feldgendarmerie, he was part of the liaison between the regular German army groups and the Einsatzgruppen, the various mobile killing squads that did much of the liquidations on the Eastern Front. Those Einsatzgruppen basically embraced, they included many elements of the OUNB and the ABN that we looked at in Side 1. There is evidence to suggest that Schwarzenegger's father was part of an underground Reich. Indeed, as we looked at in the anti-fascist classic, The Nazis Go Underground, one of the things the Nazis planned to do in order to survive the formal end of the war was to put many of their most trusted operatives into positions that would be essential for the post-war maintenance of order, such as the police. And there's evidence suggesting that Schwarzenegger's father was one of those. One of the things that we're going to look at right now, and that concerns the fact that Graz, Austria, which was not only the hometown of Schwarzenegger's mother and a city that was favored by Adolf Hitler, but Graz, Austria was an epicenter for the Rat Line. This was the Vatican-sponsored and Vatican-financed escape route for many Nazi war criminals that was, in fact, working inextricably with various elements of Western intelligence, including U.S. intelligence. And as we're going to see, not only was Graz, Austria an epicenter for the Rat Line, but it became that with the assistance of the chief of police. Schwarzenegger's father was head of the Graz Austrian Police Orchestra and then became chief of police for a tiny suburb of Graz called Thal, T-H-A-L. It's sort of like the Mayberry of Austria, so to speak. Schwarzenegger's father became chief of police and had three guys under him. One of the things we're going to ask here was Schwarzenegger's father part of the Ratline Protection Organization? We're going to take a look now at the book Unholy Trinity by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, also the authors of The Secret War Against the Jews. And they talk about some of the Croatian fascists who escaped courtesy of the Ratline and how Graz, Austria, where Schwarzenegger's father clashed with the British commissioner for that area, how Graz, Austria became an epicenter for the Ratline with the assistance of the chief of police. One of the Croatian, one of the people who assisted the Croatian fascists was Monsignor Petronovic, a Catholic prelate, and Loftus and Ahrens describe him. When asked about his post-war activities, Monsignor Petronovic cheerfully admitted that he helped, quote, a couple of thousand people, unquote, leave Italy via Genoa. When the war ended, he says he witnessed the communist massacres of captured Ustashi. After a brief stay in Zagreb, he was dispatched to the Yugoslav-Austrian border where he moved freely among the fleeing Ustashi. He settled for a time in Graz, where many notorious war criminals were hiding. His work there was aided by Bishop Ferdinand Polakowski, who obtained clearance from the local police chief to allow Petronovic to stay in Graz. Well, again, what role might Schwarzenegger's father have played? Skipping down again, talking about some of the looted World War II treasure that was used to finance the Ratline. Gowan was certain that the British were now using it to finance, quote, the Croat resistance movement in Yugoslavia. The resistance forces go by the name of Krijari, or Crusaders. Radio contact is maintained by means of a field radio operated by Vrančić, a former Pavelić minister in Croatia, located in the British zone of Austria. The Ustasha courier service within the Austrian zones is believed aided by the Roman Catholic Church in Austria. The Cardinal of Graz is known to be on close terms with Professor Droganovic, Krunoslav, known as Pavelic's contact in Rome. Pavelic was the head of the Ustashi collaborationist government in Croatia. I would also note that there appear to be numerous right-wing Catholic elements associated with Schwarzenegger's rise as a political animal. Perhaps his father's possible participation in the Ratline was part of this. The Shriver family were Opus Dei, and one of Schwarzenegger's first formal political allies in California was Mayor Richard Reardon of Los Angeles, or the former Mayor Richard Reardon of Los Angeles, a member of the Knights of Malta. For background information, do not ignore the long article-length descriptions of For the Record shows that are in the For the Record of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Sister station WFMU is maintaining two websites that are archiving the For the Record series permanently for listeners who want to either stream and or download programs. They also are podcasting the For the Record series. There is a search function on the Spitfire website and links to numerous websites, including a URL that now features not only a more compressed file of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, but also All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin and the book The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Reese. So when I talk about the Underground Reich, if it sounds crazy, check out these three books, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, The Nazis Go Underground, and All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin. They are all available for download for free on the Spitfire website. So please take advantage of that. It's also a page to click on to support the work that yours truly is doing. And if you don't like what you're seeing, there's no better way of doing something about it than to support the work that I'm doing. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 529, Nazi Roots and Fascist Flowers, being recorded on October 9th of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.